This week, we welcome Dan Purvis, Chief Executive Officer at Valentium, to discuss medical device security. In our second segment, Jill Itoro, Editor-in-Chief at SC Media, joins me for a pre-recorded interview with Elena Clark, Assistant Director for Stakeholder Engagement at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency to kick off Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. Let's face it, cyber attackers have the advantage. ExtraHop is on a mission to help you take it back. Regain the upper hand with security that can't be undermined, outsmarted, or compromised. When you don't have to choose between protecting your business and moving it forward, that's security uncompromised. See how it works in the full product demo, free online at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. People require access from anywhere to resources everywhere, but legacy security is ill-equipped for today's hybrid organization. AppGate SDP delivers zero-trust network access for hybrid workforces and workloads, empowering trusted users with secure, frictionless connections to only what they need. Make your attack surface invisible and reduce time to provision by 91% with AppGate SDP, a leader in the 2021 Forrester ZTNA New Wave. Learn more at securityweekly.com/AppGate. We're proud to announce CISO Stories, a new podcast series in partnership with Cybersecurity Collaborative and Cyber Reason. CISO Stories features the candid perspectives and experiences of frontline senior security executives and dives deep into timely security topics. CISO Stories is hosted by Todd Fitzgerald, VP of Cybersecurity Strategy at Cybersecurity Collaborative, and Sam Curry, Chief Product and Security Officer at Cyber Reason. Listen weekly as they speak with extraordinary CISOs by visiting securityweekly.com/CSP.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 234, recorded October 4th, 2021. Yes, it is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado, after just a horrible loss by the Broncos this weekend. Anyways, joining me remotely are my co-hosts, Mr. Albuquerque. Hey,
how you doing, Patriots, Matt?
Showed up. I mean, come on.
I know. You know what? We defied all odds, and I think Mac Jones impressed the hell out of the NFL. And to be honest with you, I think impressed the hell out of Tom Brady as well. So you have a lot of hope. There's light at the end of the tunnel. I think he's gonna kill it.
Yes. Also joining me, Mr. Ben Carr. The Cowboys did well this weekend.
Yes. Are you surprised by that?
With Dak, some days I do question it. I haven't seen the consistency, but he's getting better.
It'll come.
Yes, it will. Join us October 21 to learn why zero knowledge encryption matters. If you missed any of our previously recorded webcasts or technical trainings, they are available for your viewing pleasure at securityweekly.com/on-demand. Go to securityweekly.com/register, I think, webcasts. I can't remember what the original landing page is for webcasts. It's been a while. Don't miss any of your favorite Security Weekly content. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to any of our podcast feeds and have all the new episodes downloaded right to your phone. You can also join our mailing list, Discord server, and follow us on social media and our streaming platforms. Dan Purvis is Chief Executive Officer and co-founder at Valentium, a professional engineering firm that specializes in the design and manufacturing of therapeutic and diagnostic active medical devices with the goal of changing lives for a better world. A serial entrepreneur and founder of six companies, Dan has fulfilled his dream to build a company that puts culture before function, results before profit. He has more than 20 years of experience in software, electronic, and medical devices. Dan, welcome to Business Security Week.
Hey, thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Now, you're Aggie, so do you root for Houston or Dallas professionally? Just curious.
Oh, it's all Houston. And then I had a question for you. What'd you think about that run at the end of the Bronco game where Harbaugh's trying to get his team an extra 100 yards to keep the streak alive?
Well, there's been a lot of press about that one. I just 3 seconds left in the game. You want to keep the streak alive, I guess. Okay. I don't know. Kind of rubbed it in a little bit, but Denver Broncos fans, like, this is why we needed another quarterback, because the offense just cannot move the ball with Drew Lock. It's just sorry.
My hope was that the Broncos would have stuffed him, where he does what he maybe shouldn't have done, and then Broncos Nation shuts him down. Oh, well.
Oh, that would have been. Yeah, I know. I think everybody was expecting them to take a knee, but anyways. All right, let's get on to this topic, because so a little background. I think it was 2014 when Art Coviello did the keynote at RSA conference talking about the possibility that a cyber attack could actually lead to physical damage and potentially death. You know, we just went through a pandemic. We've seen a rise in ransomware attacks. There are lawsuits out there about how some of these attacks led to causes of death. I mean, this is becoming serious a little bit now, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's really true, especially in our field of medical device. You've got a different world out there, because you can't just throw a firewall into a server room and protect things, because these devices they're transportable around a hospital. They're implantable into a patient. They move wherever the patient goes, and you don't have the ability to control the environment like you do with a server room or a network. And so the challenge around embedded cybersecurity for med device, not only is it more challenging because of the size and the lack of control of the location, but it's challenging from a public health situation, that when you can use attack at the cybersecurity level to directly hurt the health of individuals or masses of individuals, it gets pretty scary quick.
Yeah, I mean, we've like I said, we've seen some of these stories in the news. And to your point, it's not a simple fix. I think there's two big challenges. One, there's a lot of legacy medical devices sitting around. And I know from my days on the nuclear side, industrial control system legacy issues, you've got them with medical devices as well. But then all these new devices with all these new capabilities have to create some very interesting cybersecurity gaps as well.
Yeah, several different challenges there. Lots of clients will come to us and say, I've got a device security issue with my med device that's been out in the marketplace for many years. What can you do? And with cybersecurity, it's different than risk management. In risk management, you talk all the time, especially with FDA, in severity and likelihood. Severity and likelihood. And yet in cybersecurity, the likelihood is always one. If there is a vulnerability, you have to assume that vulnerability will be exploited. If I have a dog in the backyard and there's a hole in the fence somewhere, it may be weeks, months, years where that dog stays in my backyard, but that dog's eventually going to find that hole. And so it's critical from the ground up to architect security into your devices, into your embedded devices, whether they be medical embedded or not. So when you look at an embedded legacy device, the challenge around creating cybersecurity and vulnerability resilience in a device that is already out there in the marketplace is challenging. At best, it's challenging. And so it's really important to design with security in mind. And what we see then going forward is that more and more of the marketplace, the patient populace, the doctors, the nurses, the healthcare system in general want a connected universe at the medical device level. I want my device to talk to my phone. I want that device to publish data to a cloud where the doctor doesn't have to wait till the next time I come to their office to find out information about that device. They can find out about that device whenever they choose to go look at the data in the cloud. And so more and more devices are connected because the marketplace demands it. But in that connection, there's additional vulnerability. And so how to keep this trend alive, where we want more and more connected devices, while also shoring up those devices to assure that they're just as buttoned up and invulnerable as possible, is something that we talk about in our industry all the time.
But Dan, given everything you've said, Dan, is like, it's a truism, right? I'm just wondering, like, why the reticence for secure by design, right? Like, you know, if you think about the medical industry in, as a whole, you could certainly segregate it into legacy devices versus new devices. But on the new device side, you would think that manufacturers would understand this at the core and really try to get in front of this with really tight secure by design practices, if any industry, right? I think, as Matt said, IoT, ICS is certainly another side of the house where we'd like to see secure by design lead the charge. But on the medical device side, why is it so hard to get the investment and to get the understanding that this is just a must-have, not a nice-to-have?
So it's definitely a maturing industry, security in any industry specific that isn't network, right? And so it's not uncommon for our clients, especially when they're startup or venture-backed clients, to not even have security on the roadmap. The average startup has licensed something out of the university. Often the founder has come out of the medical labs. And so to come into the medical device commercialization space from hard science or medical science, it's all new. The business is new. The commercialization is new. And so it's not uncommon for us to come into client engagements where they've got great science and perhaps even a prototype, but no design history file, no requirements, no design inputs, tracing to design outputs with full traceability throughout. And security is just one part of that. And so as organizations mature, they get into more and more hardened design and design process. And then as the market as a whole matures, you get more and more CISAs in medical device firms where they're like, hey, this is a real issue. We got to consider this. There have been now the first documented deaths based on attack and in the medical space over the last year. And so this continues to get more and more attention. And then the FDA got everyone's attention when they put out their latest guidance about a year and a half ago now that basically said, if you come to us for approval of your device and you don't have a cybersecurity plan, then we're just going to return your submission. And so whether it be from the growing threat out there that people start to think about it, or whether it be from the fact that you can't really get approved without it, or just the fact that you want to do the right thing, any one of those three lead more and more to secure design. And yet embedded security by design is a different animal than network-based security by design. And so in a lot of ways, I think firms are going out and finding a network cybersecurity leader, and it's different. It's different when I have to use a scalpel to replace this device. It's different when this device needs to run on battery power for 7 to 9 years. So it's just a different world in small-scale IoT embedded or medical embedded than it is in network-based cybersecurity.
And Dan, I mean, it's great to hear that there's these influences now to kind of guide organizations in the right direction. And honestly, that's where your firm comes into play, right? To bring those best practices to the table and help organizations mature. You know, it is so different than your traditional cybersecurity practice. And that's where I really start thinking, what does that process look like, right? I mean, I have a cousin of mine who has, they have a device on the back of their arm, right? For insulin, an insulin pump. It connects to the cloud. And when I'm having conversations, I mean, my head goes right to cybersecurity, right? Just naturally. So for an organization like yours that is really that business partner to these organizations, what does that process look like? What process do you bring them through to make sure that they're embedding security by design into every aspect of their manufacturing process and go-to-market process?
Great question, Jason. Yeah, the first thing I would say is that cybersecurity by design is not a aggravating adder. And so what we tell people first and foremost is that cybersecurity by design is really just good design by design. And so by having a cyber secure device that is secure by design, you will have a better design overall, not just because it's secure, but because it's better designed. And so first step in our process is getting that client or the community aware that this is the right way to go. And FDA has certainly helped with that by just saying we're not going to approve it otherwise. So then you go into a cybersecurity plan with the cybersecurity architecture, and that starts with a cybersecurity vulnerability analysis. You go through the design step by step, looking for vulnerabilities. You end up with a vulnerability score. You do mitigations. You work on those mitigations until finally your design, maybe not your implementation yet because you haven't gotten there, but your design is cybersecure. But there are several different places that you really have to focus, not just in the design itself. When we design embedded devices, you don't always write all the software from scratch. You'll have software from third parties. You'll have software that is free and out there. And you have to know all of that software is in your device. It's called the Software Bill of Materials. It's a new focus of FDA, and it's really, really important because if you have your software bill of materials, you know exactly what's in your device, you know exactly what versions are in your device, then you can track vulnerabilities over time. It's not just a one-time vulnerability assessment. It's I know what software is in my device, and now there's been a vulnerability exposed in some third-party software. Is that third-party software in my device or not? Nope, it was an earlier version. Okay, no problem. It is in my device. So now I know I have a vulnerability. And now you get to a really powerful and yet very scary term of firmware over the air, FODA. Firmware over the air, the ability to beam in new brains, essentially, to a medical device. And when we say beam in, it could literally be beam in beneath the skin to an implantable device, an implantable device that is life-sustaining, that is life-giving. And so working people through the process of starting with vulnerability assessment, moving on to software bill of materials, and then architecting in the ability to beam in or pass in firmware over the air to a new version of that embedded device is all important, because if I have a vulnerability in the software, I need to be able to fix it by passing that in. When you think about firmware over the air on a life-sustaining device, there's actually 21 steps to that, and maybe I would plug at this point. We wrote this book last year, Medical Device Cybersecurity, and it's Embedded Medical Device Cybersecurity. And in this book, we talk about firmware over the air. We talk about the 21 steps. And the reason that there are so many steps is you have to take the existing firmware and put it off to the side within the device, bring in the new firmware, confirm that that new firmware is actually legit. Once you have assured that it's legit, you install it. You have to confirm that that installation was complete. And then you can release the old firmware. At any time, if anything goes wrong with that, you have to be able to put the old firmware back in place and have the device work as it was before, because this device could be pacing someone's heart, for example. Not the kinds of things that you want to stop. And so the level
brings
of rigor...
Brings a whole new meaning to downtime, doesn't it, Dan?
Yeah.
When you think about
breath.
Downtime,
we're going
to
turn you back on
to reboot the pacemaker. Yeah, it's not probably a great idea.
Yeah. The last thing you saw was the scrolling, deal on your... Yeah, that's not okay. So
I'm seeing a blue screen.
Yeah, so firmware over the air is the next step in that process. And then, Jason, just to round it out, the fourth step in that process is manufacturing security. Now we're starting to bridge the gap back into network cybersecurity, making sure that wherever these embedded devices are manufactured, that they're manufactured in a secure way. And so that goes along with different crypto devices that are in that device so that it can validate that a new firmware over the air upload or download into it is accurate, shared secrets, etc. But then also that in my manufacturing process that I break off the JTAG at the end, I disable things to where you can't get into that device in any other way than what we've intended is really important. Because if you can load that first version of firmware with problems, known nefarious problems, then you've introduced vulnerabilities after the design, but before the release into the patient. And so manufacturing cybersecurity, that in the manufacturing process, as we build the device that has been approved by FDA, is the final step of those four. Vulnerability assessment, SBOM, software bill of materials, firmware over the air, and then finally manufacturing security.
Awesome. Thank you for that overview. I mean, I just, in just thinking what a complicated process that must be, it's good to hear that you have all those covered. And my next question just leads into, where does the human factor come into play, right? What are we doing from, again, the end user side of the aisle with a lot of data, a lot of cloud access into applications and maybe mobile apps that they can, access telemetry on? How are we ensuring that those end users are secure from a data privacy perspective? I think that's another
sure.
piece that we need to look at, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. Patient health information, or PHI, is a real issue. You want to make sure that the ability to have access to this information does not necessarily equal the permissibility of access of this information. Mm-hmm. And then the aggregate of all of this information is also extremely valuable to manufacturers, to others that may want to try to get at that, and to the general public and public health. And so when we're sending this data around, and this gets back into network cybersecurity, but it happens at the embedded level as well, data at rest, data in motion, making sure that it's encrypted throughout, and that this data that is moving around is moving around in an encrypted fashion. You've got a lot of different end users. Our cybersecurity practice and our usability practice within the firm are very related, because there's making sure that bad people can't get in is very important. And just as important as that is making sure that the good people trying to use it aren't misusing it on accident, right? So that when I hand a mobile device to a patient, they don't have the ability of increasing the current or the voltage on their neurostimulator beyond a safe level. But when I hand a device to a doctor or a caregiver, they have the ability to go beyond the bounds of what the patient could do, because they're sitting there as the direct caregiver with the ability to set something that may be unique for a given patient. And so different levels, different fail safes, and different alarms for different users is critical. And then when I send that data, that patient health information, their private health information into the cloud, who can see it? When is it just for the patient? When is it for the patient and the caregiver? What about the manufacturer? You want to be able to give some of this information to the manufacturer at an aggregated or a generic anonymized level, because it allows them to build better devices and learn for the future. Whose data is that? Who gets access to that data? These are questions that go beyond design engineering firms like us. We watch the regulations and we hold those very closely.
Dan, you've created some nice chatter on YouTube as we're live streaming this. And one of the questions that came through was, I think Valentium really looks at it from the design engineering process, but we're starting to get questions like, are there products out there that can actually validate and test devices that are already done? Like, how would you understand where some of these vulnerabilities are of existing devices because they're already in the field? Are there systems and solutions out there to help identify where the potential attack surface is?
So yeah, there are firms. It's a delicate balance, right? Because there are a lot of vulnerable devices out in the marketplace. And so the question becomes, do you get the attention of manufacturers to say, hey, this has got to be fixed going forward? Because that is the solution, is to fix it going forward, right? The most secure solution that any patient has is to upgrade to a device that has been designed secure from the ground up. To the extent that you have a legacy device, there are most likely vulnerabilities. And so you have to weigh that and say, well, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for the life of my device, et cetera? There have been interest groups, I guess we could call, that have hacked medical devices to prove to the community that it's possible. But then there are other groups, ourselves included, that if we're hired by a company that says, hey, we want you to get into our device, we can do that. And we can do that for that company on behalf of that company to show vulnerabilities to that company to assure that they know how to securely design in the future. We're pretty careful at our firm.
Difference in the ethics of a responsible disclosure program, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So there were companies of past that it's like, hey, if I have an event, I don't really want to talk about that event. It's now illegal not to, right? You have to say, hey, we have this vulnerability. You have to talk about what your medical vulnerability has been, what you found. And so in that world, and I think it's a good world that is more open and more disclosed, it forces the medical community as a result to take this seriously as a real, not just a social public health issue, not just as a reputation issue, but also as a business issue, is that you have to, if you're going to assure profitability going forward, assure that your devices are secure.
Yeah, and the tools we use here are different, right? I mean, looking for vulnerabilities at the firmware level, looking for vulnerabilities in some of this code, some of that may be reusable, but I mean, it's a different world, and the tool sets little different. We're so used to the commercial network security stuff that these tools are kind of highly specialized, aren't they?
I mean, you can get a BLE sniffer that will show you what's going on between your cell phone and the speakers in your car. You can get I like many engineers thought that once code was compiled that it was secure, because now it's just ones and zeros. And our security expert at our firm has taken compiled code and shown me the source code. And so back compiling compiled code into source code brings up a whole nother issue that maybe somebody who is going after your devices has not gone after it as a public health issue, has not gone after it as a ransomware issue. They're just going after it as a, we want to know how you did it. And so just to protect your business and your business IP is another aspect of this. But yeah, a BLE sniffer that is just sitting there watching the data communication, that digital communication between the device inside of you to your handheld phone, that can open a lot of eyes.
I think you've developed some courses. I want people to know where to go. Like, how do they learn more? How do they learn about your process? You had the book out there, but I think you've also done some training courses and some other stuff, because if people are in the space, I want to point them to some resources that they might be able to use and leverage to help educate them.
Sure, Matt. Appreciate that. We looked far and wide because it's a real huge demand right now. Like, everybody has got to have a cybersecurity architecture for their medical device if you're going to get it approved. And quite honestly, so we can all sleep at night, right? So we looked and looked and looked, and finally we wrote the book. And so that was step one. And then I said, I want to create a series of courses that people could take alongside of the book. Some people, they come to us, they say, we want to work with your company because we read your book, we love the process, but we want you just to handle it. And we can do that. We also love for clients to handle it themselves using the tools and the techniques that we teach. And so if you're a book reader, you can read that book, you can highlight it and thumbnail different things and nail it. That's great. Or if you want to take cybersecurity medical device level 1, 2, and 3 from us, we teach this as multi-day courses complete with a certification exam at the end of those courses. And so you can become a level 1 medical embedded cybersecurity expert. You can become a level 2 and a level 3 embedded medical cybersecurity expert. You can find that at valentium.com. There's a banner across the bottom that appears when you go to valentium.com that talks to you all about the different levels. And then we're working towards a summit in August of next year where we'll gather industry leaders in embedded medical cybersecurity and just have a conference where we talk about best practices. So that's another way you could come to the conference, you could come to one of the courses, you could just read the book, or obviously we'd love to talk to you and serve you directly.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly and talking about medical device security.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a quick break and then air our pre-recorded interview with Elena Clark from CISA.
Cybersecurity is about more than just technology. It's about how people behave with emails, data, and cloud applications that directly impacts your company's security posture. Security works best when it's ingrained in the culture of your organization. To learn how to build a security culture and transform your employees from targets into a strong line of defense, head to securityweekly.com/proofpoint and visit their Cybersecurity Awareness Center. Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by my special co-host, Jill Itoro, editor-in-chief for SC Media. Jill, welcome.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we have a special guest to kick off Cybersecurity Awareness Month, but first, I have two quick announcements. Security Weekly Unlocked will be held in person this December 5th through 7th at the Hilton Lake Buena Vista. We're excited to announce our first round of speakers. Visit securityweekly.com/unlocked to register and check out our rockstar lineup. InfoSec World 2021 is proud to announce its keynote lineup for this year's event. Hear from Robert Herjavec, plus heads of security at the NFL, TikTok, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Stanford University, and more. Plus, Security Weekly listeners save 20% on digital pass registration. Visit securityweekly.com/ISW2021 to register now. Elena Clark is the Assistant Director for Stakeholder Engagement at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. As Assistant Director, she leads CISA's efforts to promote and deliver strategically aligned stakeholder engagements, helping achieve a secure and resilient infrastructure. Ms. Clark most recently served as Deputy Chief of CISA's Office of External Affairs, where she oversaw the agency's public messaging, legislative agenda, and branding. Prior to her work at CISA, Ms. Clark served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Department of Homeland Security Office of Intergovernmental Affairs from 2013 to 2019. Elena, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you, Matt. Truly a pleasure to be here with you today and looking forward to the conversation with you and Jill today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. This is kind of our kickoff for Cybersecurity Awareness Month. But before we get into some of the questions, I'd love you to just kind of give a background on CISA and its mission, just so everybody kind of understands kind of the role of CISA across the government today.
Absolutely. So CISA is about 3 years old now. So it's really an exciting time for us. And our mission space is really focused on defending today those threats that we're dealing with, while also securing tomorrow. So we work to protect our critical infrastructure while buying down the risk as well from those threats that we're facing across physical security, emergency communications, as well as the cybersecurity front as well. And we also have our National Risk Management Center that's looking across all three of those mission spaces to help buy down those risks. And we work both at a national level, but then we've got this great field force that is spread out across the country that is working locally with our private sector partners, critical infrastructure, and our state and locals to help them as well, recognizing those risks and providing them those resources and tools to protect those networks and their infrastructure as well.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of work with InfraGuard today on some critical infrastructure stuff. And I think you work with the InfraGuard groups. Are they part of your kind of public-private relationship as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And we work with a lot of those chapters locally. So our regional directors and some of our protective security advisors are working hand in hand across the country with InfraGuard. And then we work at that national level. We connect in with the FBI directly as well with that.
Great. Sorry, Elena, Jill. I first of all want to say I'm really excited to have you here and to be chatting. So thank you so much for taking the time. I know with it being Awareness Month kicking off, it's certainly a busy time for all of you. I did want to ask, CISA, you mentioned, is 3 years old. There's new leadership even within that 3 years that just came in. We have heard about a lot of cyber initiatives coming out of the Biden administration. Can you tell me, if you had to put into words what is right at the forefront, front and center for CISA, what would you describe that as in the here and now?
Absolutely. So we, as you mentioned, we've got some new leadership. It's a really exciting time for us. I would say, starting with new authorities from the NDAA, new executive orders, a new administration, our new director, Jen Easterly, our new deputy, Nitin Natarajan, and then our new chief of staff, Kirsten Todd. So they just bring a wealth of knowledge. They have a lot of energy and support from the team with these appointments. So I would say right now, the director's looking at our mission space through three big lenses. And that first one is through people. So this really goes to the culture and the workforce, being able to retain great talent, because we're constantly, trying to hire and compete with the private sector. And the director is just placing a lot of emphasis right now in this area and wants CISA to be that cutting edge federal agency that everybody wants to come and work for. And under this effort, actually, just moments ago, the director announced a partnership with Girls Who Code. And this is really going to focus on pathways for young women to pursue careers in cybersecurity and technology. So again, just trying to look at those innovative ways to draw talent to CISA. The second bucket that we're really focused in around is visibility. And this goes to the operational side, both on the physical and the cyber side, and just making sure that our partners have the information that they need to make those informed decisions, whether that's infrastructure security, emergency communications, or cybersecurity. And the big announcement, I would say, in this area most recently is the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative, which I'm sure we'll touch on a little bit later, or JCDC, but really, again, making sure that the information we have is getting into the hands of our partners. And the third one that we are really focused on is partnerships. You know, a majority of what CISA does is based on voluntary partnerships. Outside of .gov or our CFETS responsibility, everything is about voluntarily bringing partners to the table, whether that's industry, SLTT, international partners. You know, they are key to this collaborative defense model, and we need everyone working towards that common goal to protect our critical infrastructure. And this voluntary model with our partnerships is what makes CISA so unique within the government. And October and Cybersecurity Awareness Month truly fall, you know, within this area of focus of partnerships, being able to provide the resources and the tools that both the public and the critical infrastructure partners can use to harden their personal and business networks.
Yeah, why don't you tell me a little bit more about that in terms of Awareness Month? What are you putting out there and offering in particular to the cybersecurity community and industry partners that can kind of contribute to their efforts?
Absolutely. So I think most people know about October as Cybersecurity Awareness Month, but if you're new to it, it's actually 18 years old. We're very excited about this. Yes. Yeah. And so during this month, we're really working to invite organizations and individuals to raise their awareness about the importance of cybersecurity across the nation. So we're working very closely with our federal government partners, industry, international partners, and our state and local governments to partner with us on the nation's cybersecurity posture. This is really to help engage staff and communities and the public through all of the resources that we'll put out. So we have a website on CISA.gov under Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we've got some great toolkits there so that the partners can learn how to effectively communicate with their members. We actually have the toolkit now available in 5 languages, Spanish, Portuguese, French, Arabic, and traditional Chinese. So very excited this year to be able to provide that to our partners. And this year, the overall theme is do your part, be cyber smart. And each week in October, we're highlighting different ways individuals and organizations can improve their cybersecurity efforts, whether they're at home, at work, or at school. So the first week, which is October 4th to the 8th, is be cyber smart. So it's just taking those simple actions to keep our digital lives secure, like using multi-factor authentication. The second week, October 11th to the 15th, is fight the phish. And the director is particularly excited about this one. And this is really learning how to spot those phishing attempts to prevent ransomware and other malware attacks. The third week is the 18th to the 22nd. And this is, we're calling it Explore, Experience, Share. And this is really learning about careers in cybersecurity. And we're going to be joining the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education, or NICE, as they also celebrate Cybersecurity Career Awareness Week. So you're going to see everything the third week of October really focus on that career workforce development. And then the last week is cybersecurity first. So just being able to explore, you know, how cybersecurity and staying safe online is increasingly important as our world just continues to operate in this virtual environment, both work and personal, and just always thinking about cybersecurity as you're going to click and use whatever device it might be.
That's great.
Elena, when I think about some of the challenges around cybersecurity awareness, for a second, I always equate it to more of a safety discussion than a security discussion, because I think we have to win over the hearts a little bit in these conversations. I'm curious, how do you balance some of this awareness education with really trying to instill how to be safer, especially at home when you have other people in the household online? Do you think about it from a safety perspective, or do you still think it more about a security perspective? I'm just curious how CISA approaches it.
So I think it's a little bit of both. And just this past year, you know, with COVID, we actually put out a lot of guidance, you know, to schools as children were home and connecting online from their home networks and just providing that advice. So it's definitely both. So, you know, Cybersecurity Awareness Month really is focused on the American public and our international partners as well, trying to get them this information. But then there's also that tactical, you know, for the technicians, there's information there as well. So I definitely think it's a little bit of both. And I think that in this COVID environment and everything going virtual, it just reinforced the need to look at it from both perspectives.
Yeah, definitely, especially with the rise of ransomware, we've seen just that continual uptick because we are at such a risk for some of these attacks. You talked about multi-factor authentication and email phishing. I mean, those are just two basic foundational elements that I think if more people understood, we'd be in a much better position.
Absolutely.
You also talked about the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative and some of the other efforts out there around partnerships. Can you give us a little more insight into the JCDC and other partnerships? We talked a little bit about InfraGuard and FBI, but I would love to understand, you know, how do we build a broader partnership across the entire cybersecurity industry?
Absolutely. So I'll touch on the JCDC. So the Joint Cyber Defense Collaborative, again, very excited. You might think it sounds like AC/DC. Our director is very much an 80s band fan. So you might see music themes throughout different announcements that we make. But, you know, through the JCDC, I would just say the federal government, you know, we've tried different approaches to public-private partnerships and information sharing over the years, and we've had varying, you know, degrees of success. And the JCDC is bringing all the lessons learned and the best practices from both government and the private sector to make some fundamental changes that are reimagine, you know, that public-private partnerships at the operational collaboration level. So from a prevention perspective, we must strengthen our joint capability to comprehensively plan across the U.S. government and with the private sector to prevent or reduce these cyber impacts. And the JCDC is a really unique capability. So it's a formal framework that brings together key federal partners with private sector who have critical visibility and ability to by virtue of their businesses, to focus very specifically on the plans to prevent and better manage incidents. So through JCDC, we're really aiming to understand the threat landscape so we can recognize the changes and the trends and share information and take those joint collective actions before an incident occurs. So, you know, I'm sure many folks saw as the Cyberspace Solarium Commission observed, effective cyber planning ensures that the government aligns its full range of tools in cyberspace and coordinates jointly with the private sector so that they can be integrated seamlessly in advance of any incident to occur. And right now we are responding to cyber incidents, and that's important, but the JCDC is really going to be focusing on bringing the community together across agencies and the private sector in a unified way to develop those comprehensive cyber defense plans. And then not just develop the plans, but then go and exercise those plans collectively as well. So very excited to see the direction that this is going. We're very excited for our plankholders that joined us, and there'll definitely be more to come on the JCDC in the coming months.
I'd love to jump in real quick. How has the response been from the private sector in terms of involvement, partnership in that effort, and how much of effort is being made to kind of get the cross industry input, you know, whether it be from the major players that I know you all work with pretty frequently, down to the mid-size and even smaller organizations that find themselves being targeted in different ways and facing different struggles. Has the response been pretty solid?
It's been very positive. And I think folks saw, especially with the rollout and the plank holders that we announced, we were able to get a number of partners from IT and comm sector to the table to be those plank holders with us and sit down and help to really design and stand this up. And our idea is that this will really help to benefit the entire community, that the information that is here will help those small and medium businesses. We do a lot of information sharing through our sector risk management agency models. So we're working with all 16 critical infrastructure sectors to help get information out. So this will have a much broader reach than folks that are just plank holders or happen to join later. So you don't necessarily need to be at the table at the beginning to get the benefits of the JCDC once it's completely up and running.
I'm curious, is it just limited to the 16 critical infrastructure sectors, or can others get involved? Because I'm curious about some of the takeaways for others that might be interested in learning or leveraging the resources, but they're not part of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors.
So that's a great question. So we talk daily to all kinds of partners. So I like to frame it as, you know, there's a structured way that we can engage with critical infrastructure. But if for some reason you're not falling within that structured environment, you can come to us direct. And that's what the stakeholder engagement division is here for, so that we can have both those structured and unstructured ways of engaging with partners. And it's very easy to get a hold of CISA central at CISA.gov. And then they'll send you our way. So I am regularly holding calls with associations and different organizations to get them connected to CISA and our resources and get them plugged in to our alerts and make them and have the baseline understanding of how to get this information to better secure their network. So you don't necessarily have to be aligned with one of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors. We will still work with you. We will still share information with you. We want you at the table with us. Again, this goes to that collaborative defense and being able to build up the resiliency and the of the critical infrastructure nationwide.
So stakeholder engagement is, it's funny because I know that's at the core of what CISA stands for. So you have a big job in terms of leading that effort. I mean, this may sound like a silly question, but from CISA's perspective, how would you define the stakeholder? Because really in cybersecurity, as you know, it's really everyone from private sector executives all the way down to the end user. But from your perspective of as a government agency that's leading this collaboration, who are you really focusing on in terms of trying to establish a relationship?
So we're focused with the 16 critical infrastructure sectors, a lot of the associations that also represent them so that they also have a voice as well. So being able to work with them to get out a broader message, all of our state and local governments. We're also working with the international community as well, because again, threats don't start at our borders. We need to be mindful of being able to reach out to the international community as well. So those are a key group. So, but then we also, you know, with Cybersecurity Awareness Month, the focus there is the public. So, you know, we're viewing everybody as part of the solution because we need everybody to be able to help build their resilience within cybersecurity.
And if you were to ask anything of the stakeholders, you know, you mentioned Awareness Month is about the public awareness, but it's also about, you know, encouraging those that are more technically aware and within the security community to be involved. You know, as you collaborate with the private sector and with the cybersecurity community, what are you hoping they will do, you know, with their own stakeholders, whether it be their workforce, their customers? Is there any ask that CISA has for them?
Absolutely. So it comes down to basic cyber hygiene. Being able to, you know, put some of those basic elements in place. And we built some cyber essentials, and it's basically six toolkits that help that executive have those basic conversations. One of the key ones for us is multi-factor authentication and making sure that when you individually or as a business are logging into locations, you know, for financial, whether it's banking or other personal areas where your information is held, that you are putting multi-factor authentication on those applications. So definitely it just goes back to some of those basic cyber hygienes, which is why Cybersecurity Awareness Month is focused around some of those themes with be cyber smart, you know, fight the phish. And again, just some of those basics, because that, you know, unfortunately, the individual sometimes is the weakest link in this. So being able to just build that baseline with the community is very helpful.
Yeah. And I know you mentioned workforce, and when CISA even came out with a lot of the push to improve workforce and to enable a larger cybersecurity workforce for government and private sector, there were a lot of technology companies that came out and committed to some huge numbers in terms of training and hiring that had to seem like a great success for CISA overall, I have to imagine. We saw Microsoft and others come out with some pretty major announcements. So expanding the awareness through the workforce, I'm sure, is big. I know CISA is having its cyber summit also this month. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
I will. I am so very excited about this one. I have fortunately been involved with this now for 3 years, but it is actually the fourth cybersecurity summit, and it will kick off on October 6th, and it will run for 4 weeks in October. So the first week, the theme is focusing on vulnerability management and the ecosystem. The second week will be on collaborating for that collective defense. The third week, as I had mentioned, everything week three in October is on the cyber workforce. And then the fourth week is really going to focus on the power of partnership. So again, just kind of that common theme throughout our discussion today, just demonstrating where those, how powerful those partnerships are, and just some of the key ones that we have here. So I'd say the audience more for the summit is probably more of your practitioner, where Awareness Month is really more general public. But the summit is free to sign up for. So I highly encourage you to go to CISA.gov, sign up for it. Last year we had 15,000 attendees. So we're really hoping to hit that mark and kind of surpass it this year as well. So very excited to kick that off next week on October 6th.
Great.
Yeah, I was going to ask how you register. So you gave us all that information. And it's free. So show up, right?
Yep. And if you register, you will then get the early teasers of who we will be highlighting and who our speakers and our panels are. So we have not teased that yet. But if you register, you'll get some of that information ahead of time. So highly encourage you to register for the event. And we hope to see you there. We'll also be having a discussion, you know, online via Twitter through our social media handles. So you can engage in the conversation that way as well while you're watching.
That's great. One final point. We've seen a lot around zero trust in the federal agencies through some of the executive orders. I'm curious how that's going to come into some of CISA's work around, you're doing parts of it right now with multi-factor authentication, right? Because identity is one of the pillars in zero trust, but there's others. How do you think about the zero trust kind of requirements at the agencies and how that fits into CISA's programming and partnerships going forward? I'm just curious if you have any thoughts there.
Sure, absolutely. So you might see that highlighted in our summit this month as well with our interagency partners, but working very closely with our chief technology officer here, who is working interagency wide, as well as with our Office of Management and Budget. So zero trust is key and essential to kind of how we think about cybersecurity going forward. And we just highly encourage you to tune into the summit to hear more about it direct from CISA.
See, you didn't even pay me $20 to tease that out of you. Jill, before we depart, do you have any final questions for Elena?
No, I would just say, you know, if you had advice, we're focusing a lot also on the government agencies. We've talked to you quite a bit about partners with private sector, but within government, I mean, they have a lot on their plate right now with all the various orders out of the administration. Have you seen a lot of collaboration from within?
Absolutely. We are working very closely with the White House, with the new National Cyber Director, with the NSC as well, but with our interagency partners. So it is so key to our success and for the, again, that collaborative defense perspective. So very excited. It's also very helpful with our director's background. She's been in this space before, knows a lot of the players. So it's a very easy partnership and engagement with our interagency partners on this effort.
That's great. That's great. Well, I want to thank you, at least I'm sure Matt will too, but thank you for joining us so much. It's been really great having a conversation.
Well, thank you, Jill. And thank you, Matt. I truly appreciate having the opportunity to be with you guys today and to highlight everything that's going on in October for CISA.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly. And Jill, thank you for joining me today as my co-host. Thank you, everyone,
for
watching.
Thanks
for having me, Dan. Oh, you're welcome. And thank everyone for watching and listening. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.